today. This is Fresh Air. It's 2 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. According to my guest, Dr. George Gerbner, TV dramas and sitcoms distort reality. Americans watch so much TV that their views of reality become distorted by TV's misrepresentations. Dr. George Gerbner is one of America's leading mass media analysts, and since 1964 he served as the dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Since the 1960s, he's directed many studies of TV, which have led to very interesting conclusions. For instance, there is 10 times more crime on TV than in real life. People who watch a lot of TV are more afraid that they will be the victims of violent crime than are people who watch less TV. Gerbner has studied how primetime depicts women, minorities, the elderly, and the mentally ill, and has described the stereotypes that TV sometimes perpetuates. He's found that 1 out of every 3 businessmen is cast as a villain. And in a study of TV ministries, he concluded that most TV evangelists preach to the already converted and that they don't draw people away from attending church. At the networks, the reaction to Gerbner's work has been no comment, or they have challenged his methodology. Dr. George Gerbner grew up in Hungary. He fought in the U.S. infantry in World War II. He started his career in 1942 as a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, but his interest soon shifted from practicing journalism to researching the mass media's impact on society. George Gerbner, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
You've said that in many ways TV satisfies many of the same needs of religion. How is that?
Well, may I first just say that I'm not alone in all these studies that you've mentioned, and I'd like to stress that my partners, Dr. Larry Gross, Dr. Nancy Signorelli, Dr. Michael Morgan, and in some studies, Dr. Stuart Hoover, we're all work together and are instrumental in most of what we do. I think television is a new religion. I see television not as a medium that people select out to cultivate their own tastes and their own ideas, but it's an environment into which infants are born. Today, for the first time in human history, infants are born into a home in which the set is on an average of 7 hours and 7 minutes a day. This is like the wallpaper. You absorb its patterns as you grow up without even knowing it, and they'll always be familiar to you. The only cultural enterprise that did anything like that was pre-industrial religion, kind of tribal community religion, which involved the entire community, and which combined all the stories and the myths and the rituals and the ceremonies that explain to most people what we today call art and science and the origin of life and the meaning of and the conduct of the universe in a holistic and organized way. Then it became religion or ritual, and today television serves that function. So that as we're born and grow up in it, we almost unwittingly absorb its patterns to the extent that one can identify patterns that cut across different kinds of programming, that cut across even news and entertainment. And I think that this is what we've been trying to do, to find out what are the central trends of that world that television presents to all of us.
So television, you think, is like religion in that it has certain stories and certain rituals that we all share, that we grow up into. And I guess maybe that's even more so now that television has reruns of itself, because you don't even have to tell your children about what Leave It to Beaver was like. They can watch it themselves. And probably a lot of parents are encouraging their children to do that so that they understand the past.
That it's, and it's amazing. It's like a pulpit in every home, in which a faithful messenger comes, and we pay for it, so that there's been no instrument quite like that in the history of humankind.
And what impact do you think it has on us that night after night and day after day, so many of us turn on the TV and watch the same stories?
That is the big question that we're trying to investigate. There's been a great deal of speculation, and now more and more our results have accumulated from some 17 or 18 years of study. A number of independent investigators have also found much of the same results and in many ways refined and corrected some of our early findings. And we find really two things. Television selects out On the whole, those things that the institutional broadcasting as a business, as a social institution, wants to emphasize as important for its clients. Its clients are mostly the advertisers. And so that there is a particular way of selecting out features of the world that illuminate the world from the point of view of the institution. And we find that that point of view is a very particular and in many ways a peculiar point of view, even though it selects out subjects and themes and aspects of life and people that conform to some conventional expectations and values. And we can talk about some of the specific subjects, but on the whole, we find that the exposure to the same stories most of the time means that the usual differences among different groups of people, young and old, rich and poor, different religious, ideological, ethnic groups, tend to be absorbed into what we call the television mainstream. So when you think about society and think about all the differences and the pluralistic makeup of large modern societies like the United States, those distinctions and those differences exist mostly among the light viewers. The heavy viewers somehow converge or are absorbed or tend to be closer together, a bit homogenized, so to speak, into a more standardized view of life, which is the view of life and the world according to television. Now, for some people, this is a great enrichment because there used to be people who are parochial, who are out of it, who are ill in hospitals or who are in prisons or who are very young and therefore could not share in the cultural mainstream. Today, that's gone. We all share in it, but it's a fairly standardized mainstream. And therefore, the question today becomes, what kind of a world does it present to all of our children to grow up in and all the rest of us to cultivate our imagination and our mentalities?
Before I ask you to attempt to answer some of the questions that you just raised, I'd like to hear about why you started studying television yourself. I think you're really one of the first people to do the kind of content analysis that you've been doing for several years now. Now, you started off as a journalist. You started off as a participant in the mass media. And then you shifted to being someone who reflects on the mass media. Were you dissatisfied with journalism?
Yes, but I didn't know it. I happened to, in looking at things from retrospect, it seems that it was foreordained, but at the time, everything seemed accidental. I was a journalist before I entered or joined the United States Army and then OSS, and then came back in 1946. My wife and I, we married overseas and came back, and I was looking for a job in journalism in the Los Angeles area, which is where I used to live. And while I was waiting, on a Thursday, I got a telephone call saying that the journalism instructor in a junior college in Pasadena suddenly had to leave or left to take up another job. And would I mind, as long as I'm not doing anything interesting or anything remunerative, would I mind filling in for him on a Monday until they find a permanent person or I find what I was looking for? And I said, might as well, I don't mind. I started teaching that Monday and have been teaching ever since. I discovered that being an academic, being a teacher, allows me to do what I want to do and much greater freedom. That as a journalist, I was a hired hand. Ultimately, I was told what stories to do. And if I wanted to do those stories from my own point of view, I was told whether or not that conforms with the policies of somebody else. Also, I had a background. I was, as you said, born and raised in Hungary. And my earliest interest and academic kind of preoccupation was folklore. So I also had a great interest in the popular stories of the day, the folk art in that part of the world, of course, in the villages and on the countryside. And so I also discovered that kind of folk art no longer exists, that it has been replaced by industrially produced, by mass-produced artifacts that very little of what people today use and animates their imagination is spontaneous, is authentic expression of their own interests, that in effect is manufactured for them, so that we have an industrialization of consciousness, an industrialization of the mind, which I think is one of the most fundamental processes that we have to understand. So I increasingly become interested in analyzing and understanding it, not just running around trying to work in it without the kind of reflection and the kind of opportunity that an academic life provides.
When you entered the academic world, it was in, I guess, the mid or the late 40s, and at that time, radio was still the predominant electronic media. Some people had TVs, but very few people had TVs then. When did you start thinking of television?
Well, you'd be surprised. I wrote my master's thesis on television and education in 1950. And in 1950, there was no national service. There were regional and local television stations, and there was a growing amount of literature and interest. And that was probably the first academic exercise in this field. I didn't stay with television all the time. I did and do studies in the press, in films, in other media. But I find that television has become the central mainstream. It has reorganized cultural life. It has affected publishing. It has affected movies. It has affected all other media. And therefore, you cannot separate it from concern with culture in general.
You didn't grow up with TV. TV came of age.
Nobody of my age grew up with TV.
Exactly, right. Did you ever go through a period of just loving TV and thinking that it was a magical thing and a very entertaining program service before you started jumping in and studying it?
No, because I wasn't born into... I'm not a member of the television generation. I looked upon TV as just another new medium, which one uses selectively, like going to the movies or reading books. Then I discovered that the television generation, and our studies show that the television generation doesn't look at it that way. The television generation looks at it as the background against which they judge all other media and even themselves. In other words, it's the background assumptions that they absorb as they grow up. It's not something that they choose. It's not something that they program. It's something that programs them. And therefore, it becomes important to raise our consciousness of that process, to find out where the sources of our ideas really come from, and to distance ourselves from that to which we are all too accustomed, which we take for granted, which is all too familiar. So in my classes, for example, the first task is to defamiliarize people, to try to suggest that things that they know very well, they think they know very well, that they have taken for granted, contain a lot of hidden assumptions that they don't know about, and the question becomes how those hidden assumptions, how those points of view and aspects of life, why are they what they are? How do they come about? What are the industrial processes of decision-making and of policy that creates them? What are these mass-produced systems that surround us today? And what effect they might have on our thinking and our acting and our behavior?
You told us that partially because you didn't grow up with TV, you never just looked at it as a way to amuse yourself. You were always studying it as soon as it became available to you. Do you ever watch TV for pleasure now?
That's a question that I refuse to answer on grounds of incriminating, if not degrading me. It's my constitutional right on which I stand for the following reason. Of course I watch television. Everybody does. I watch it very selectively in a very peculiar way. Even dull and boring programs are very exciting to me because I can see in them parts of that great mosaic that our studies show exist. And so when I watch television, I ask myself, I usually, as my wife sometimes with some irritation points out to me, I look at scenes, I look at casting, I look at whether or not the action is stereotyped, whether the casting is that which is expected, or whether it somehow challenges. And every once in a while you find even in relatively poorly produced programs just a spark of something different, something that doesn't just soothe the accepted and taken for granted assumptions, but somehow challenges them. And this is what I'm watching for. Now, the reason I don't like to talk about specific programs is the same that a doctor doesn't like to talk about specific diseases, or that a meteorologist can't answer if he likes the storm or sunshine better. All these are subjects for study. And my personal selection, my personal likes and dislikes should not be mixed in with what I find in our research and in our studies. And indeed, typically they're not.
Let me ask you a slightly different version of that question then. Are there programs that you find yourself tuning to repeatedly because you think they're such good indicators of the way television is reflecting American culture?
Almost anything is. That I don't look at television. I don't think about television by programs. To talk about television by programs is what I characterize as book thinking. You think about books by titles. You think about movies by titles. You should think about television by day parts. Nobody picks out programs to watch. Very few people do, and they're very odd in many other ways, so you can't really consider them typical. People watch television as part of their style of life. If you're higher income, higher education, you have a style of life which has a great deal of diversity, you do many things, you watch more selectively, you watch fewer hours. If you come from an environment that didn't do much reading, that didn't do much concert going or play going, that didn't have a diverse cultural participation, television entered the life of that family maybe 30 or 40 years ago, and it has monopolized the life of that family. Those are the people who watch 8, 9, you know, who put on a set in the morning. It's on until they go to bed, and most of the time, whether they watch attentively or not, it doesn't matter. They absorb its patterns like a ritual, which means that it has to be the same. It is soothing. It's comforting. It reinforces their belief that things are ultimately have a happy ending. Therefore, you talk about daytime, you talk about prime time, you talk about late evening, because those are the units which most people watch.
Very briefly, there's a way that many radio people think that contradicts something that you're saying, which is a lot of radio consultants and radio analysts say that people listen to radio as a program service where they have time to listen to the radio and they'll turn it on and they'll just tune to their favorite station, as opposed to saying, oh, it's 6 o'clock, my favorite show is on, let me put on that show. Whereas these experts say that people watch television according to the program. It's 8 o'clock, my favorite show is on, I'm going to switch it on. I guess you don't think that's true.
No, I don't think that's true. If you look at the flow of audiences on television, if you examine the Nielsen ratings, you find out that prime time, the audience is always the same, regardless of the programming. They may switch to this or that program, but the total audience is always the same. People have a set style of life. They put on the television set when it's their time to put on a television set. I myself cannot do it because I have many roles, and my time is not going to be dictated by a television program. Now that we have a VCR, if I'm really interested in something and can't watch it at that time, we can record it and I can watch it some other time. So far, I haven't found any kind of irresistible impulse to do that, but it's nice to know that if I do, it's available.
My guest is Dr. George Gervner, the dean of the Annenberg School of Communications and one of America's leading mass communications analysts and researchers. Well, let's look at some of your findings over the years of how television reflects reality and
reflects whatever it selects out to claim
right.
is reality.
Okay. One of the subjects that is of concern to so many people is a subject that you've studied too, and that's violence on TV. Now, it's commonly believed or feared that violence in movies or violence on TV is going to lead to violent behavior. What you found is kind of different. Rather than it making people more violent, I think you found it makes people more paranoid that they're going to be the victims of violent crimes.
I'm glad you asked that question because I think this is one of the most widely and very often purposely misinterpreted question. When people ask about violence, they mostly ask from the point of view of law and order, of avoiding the instigation of violence, and of being afraid that the frequent violence on television will lead to more violence. And in a sense, they're right, but I think they're looking at the wrong side of the coin. First of all, indeed, there is an enormous amount of violence on television. An average of 6 incidents per hour in prime time, an average of between 20 and 25 incidents of violence in children's weekend daytime programming. Apparently our children need a much bigger dose of what can maintain us on a high level of anxiety later on. Now, clearly, to have violence, you need at least two partners, the violent and the victim. Most of us, when we think about violence, seem to put ourselves into the shoes of the victim. Very few of us go down the street and say, now, whom am I going to mug today? But there's hardly anyone anymore who does not have some apprehension on a dark night, maybe in an abandoned street. And where does that apprehension come from? We found in our studies that, well, of course, it doesn't all come from television. That television violence makes a contribution to the sense of insecurity and anxiety that most people feel because the exaggerated incidents and emphasis on violence seems to give most viewers, according to the amount they view, the impression that this is a very mean and dangerous world out there, much more so than my next-door neighbor who lives in the same world but watches less television. So the more television people watch, the more they seem to have this feeling of insecurity, feeling of dependence on authority, the feeling of demanding protection, and sometimes even repression if it comes in the name of security, so that this is a pervasive and politically and humanly potent effect that the authorities are not worried about. And I think there is a clue why it's so stubborn and why nothing has changed despite all the agitation. Because in the whole, while it is true that exposure to this kind of violence cultivates a sense of violence as a very widely available and perhaps even effective means to an end, and so that you have a slight increase in the actual violence, but of course, there are many inhibitions against that, and in most instances, violence is simply stupid and self-defeating. Whereas there are no inhibitions to fear. Nobody can stop somebody being anxious, being dependent, being insecure. But there are enormous social advantages to cultivating insecurity, which is why circuses in Rome, which is why many rituals that represent some danger from which the authorities can protect you, has historically been a very potent weapon of social control.
Are you suggesting that the violence on TV has something to do with the attempts of programming executives to exert social control over its viewers?
Well, I think it would have to be an extremely ingenious program executive to have fathomed or have figured out what we have found in our studies of many years. No, I think this is a conclusion they arrive at totally pragmatically. Violence, although every once in a while we are disturbed by the price that this great pacification exercise exerts, on the whole, I think it has become a very conventional, very relatively cheaply produced commodity. It hypes the ratings of even a very dull, very bad program. So from the point of view of broadcast executives, violence travels well. You can take it into many countries. You don't need any kind of linguistic or artistic special cultural form. There seems to be kung fu comes here. Our violence goes everywhere else. So it's relatively cheap to produce. You do it by extras. There are little cottage industries in Hollywood that produce spectacular results. You can plug them in. You don't need great talent. You don't need to give your writers long time to really figure out thoughtful solutions to human problems. So it has commercial advantages. It is conventionally now acceptable. And despite all the claims and agitations, I think they feel that it doesn't really incite nearly as many people as it pacifies because of its effect on people in the direction of what we call the mean world syndrome. If you think you live in a very mean and dangerous world, you're going to be fearful, you're going to be dependent on authority, you're going to be asking for protection, and all that is good from the point of view of social control. So that I don't believe in conspiracy theories simply because I think conspiracies don't work nearly as well as putting people into a system where the rewards and penalties almost automatically suggest to people what to do if they're going to keep their jobs, be successful, productive, and profitable.
So even though you don't think that television violence leads to more violence, you think it leads to more fear?
I think it leads to more violence on a relatively low level, and I'm not even sure that the excess violence due to television watching is primarily a result of television. Most violence in society, certainly criminal violence, has much more to do with academic trends. I mean, you have an immoral war, you have an economic downturn, you have a disruption of family structure. All these things, I think, create the predisposition, the inclination to think in terms of drastic and violent solutions. But we do find that the insecurity that television violence generates is much more pervasive. It affects maybe 997 out of 1,000 people, whereas the actual violence affects the other three.
But because of that insecurity, you're still very concerned about the amount of violence on TV.
I'm more concerned about people being controlled. I'm more concerned about people being dominated. I'm more concerned about people being made dependent than I'm concerned about people asserting themselves. See, violence is a demonstration of power. If you can't think of demonstrating your power, sometimes it's the only way against injustice, against intolerable odds. You can call that a revolution. You can call that some kind of a protest. You can call that a desperate measure when nothing else helps. So you cannot assume that violence or what we call aggressiveness is always a bad trait or is always a bad solution. Sometimes it is necessary. But you can assume that controlling people, that making people feel fearful, withdrawn, dependent, or otherwise insecure is a way of somehow denying their right to assert themselves by whatever methods they find useful.
You've studied how television portrays women, minorities, different ethnic groups, elderly people. Do you think that television is using less stereotypes in its portrayal of people now? Do you see any progress?
Well, yes and no. I think television has become somewhat more careful and more sophisticated. But the basic cultivation of different social roles. I mean, somewhere we have to learn how to grow up to be men and women, and we have to learn our age roles, and we have to learn our ethnic and many other roles. These processes of learning our roles depend on the kind of society we have. Television is the chief cultural arm of a particular social order. And whether it does it in a refined and sophisticated way or does it in a very crude and often brutal and damaging way, it has to help introduce people into the roles that our society, or at least those who manage our society, think we should have. And incidentally, you know, violence is one of the ways in which you introduce people into their level of power. Violence is a demonstration of power. And we have found that the people who commit most violence but who also get away with most, the people who can do more violence against most others, are white males in the prime of life. That if you're a woman, although you don't get into as many violent situations, if and when you do, your chances of becoming a victim are much higher. If you're a non-white, your chances of becoming a victim of violence in a violent or conflict situation are much higher than if you're a white. That is, if you are a black, your chances are much higher. So that you have an inverse power structure in which the more you are in a minority status, the higher your chance of victimization, and therefore the higher your feeling of vulnerability and dependence will be.
But television shows it the other way, because it's mostly television, I guess, is showing minority people committing crimes as opposed to being the victims of crimes.
No. The other way. Say committing crime in dramatic language is a demonstration of power. Now, it is true that you find that many of the so-called enemy stereotypes tend to be taken from minority groups, although not this is too crude. It's no longer as simple as that. What happens is that if you're a woman on television, if you're a non-white, a black person on television, if you're an old person on television, your chances of being a victim, you may be a sympathetic or even a pathetic victim, but your chances of being a victim are higher. Your vulnerabilities are greater. You can't get away with as much against various other parties as if you are a white male in the prime of life. And so that we absorb this as we grow up, and then we seem to act it out.
What about recent shows like Cagney and Lacey, which show two very strong women in the police force being able to use force when necessary, to be able to use words when necessary to either prevent a crime or snag a criminal? And then shows like The Cosby Show, which is showing the black family in a very warm and positive light, positive role models. Do you see shows like that as an example of television becoming a little more enlightened?
Yes, I think television is exploring new avenues of accomplishing old aims. And The Cosby Show, in which a black family leads essentially a white style of life, I think is a very interesting experiment. We don't study individual shows enough to give you anything but a personal opinion, which is as good as anybody else's. So I'm not going to go very far with that, because when you mention individual shows, you're really not dealing with the total environment. You're dealing with a drop in a bucket, which has, I believe, very little, if any, individual effect. No individual behavior or thought can really be attributed to a single program. But it is true that as minority characters are introduced into this great casting game, as a stable cast of about 300 characters that the average viewer of primetime sees week after week, as minority characters are introduced into the cast, they are most likely to enforce the majority order. So they're most likely to come in as policemen or women or as helpers of the authority figure, because this is the safest and, in a way, easiest way to ease them into that world. Whether they become the bankers, the executives, the political leaders, the real authority figures who don't just enforce the laws but who make the laws, would be a big next step. And once we take that step, then you can begin to talk about a more significant change.
My guest is Dr. George Gerbner, the dean of the Annenberg School of Communications and one of America's leading analysts of the mass media, specifically of television. Well, in talking about television, you've used phrases like the cultural arm of the social order, and you referred to those who manage our society. Now, if you talk to a network executive about why programs are produced the way they are, they'll say, we produce what people want to see. And if people don't want to see it and they don't tune in, we stop producing it. And if it's popular, meaning that people do want to see it, we'll deliver more programs, not only of that series, but they'll probably manufacture more programs like it. What do you see as being some of the forces at the TV network level that decide how women are going to be depicted or how black families are going to be depicted or how much violence there's going to be? Do you see it as being having to do with sponsors or ratings or social images that the network executives have in mind that they want to communicate on TV? What are some of the forces you see?
All of the above. The primary forces are the forces that control marketing or that calculate the advantages and the effectiveness of programming in a market. The product of television is not programs, but people. What television does is package people. The unit is cost per thousand. How many people, or let's say the time and attention of how many people and what kind of people can you sell to the advertisers. So there is a client relationship between the producers, mostly the networks, and the big advertising agencies that dominates this situation. These are very pragmatic people. They have few degrees of freedom. The competition is keen. A 1 percentage point in the ratings means several million dollars profit or income over the course of a season, even though socially it means nothing. 1 percentage point is well within the margin of error. This is an artificial pricing mechanism. So that there is a very tightly constructed system. And if you're in that system, you as a professional, you want to rationalize it. You want to give people an explanation of why it is, and one way of rationalizing it is that this is what the people want. That, of course, is ridiculous. People are born into this system. They're born into a television environment. Nobody asked them what it should be. Depending on what system you have, is different in every country. It's equally popular when it's a totally different system. So that the voice that people ought to have over the system is a voice as citizens, a voice as the makers, or at least the participants in the making of policy, not only as consumers. As a consumer, you're not a full-fledged citizen. You are led into a cafeteria and you're told, these are your choices, what do you like? You're hardly ever told, is this the kind of cafeteria you would like to go into? That choice becomes a choice of a citizen. In our system, the choice of a citizen is one of begging, of petitioning. There is no direct access of citizens to policy making. The people who make policy are not elected. They're not even known by most people. They're part of a very tightly constructed marketing system. And I think that this is one of our major political, upcoming political problems of the future. How should we structure citizen participation in the making, in the mass production of the environment in which our children will grow up?
Well, there are many public interest groups now competing for network executives' attention and trying to influence them. And I could think of a lot of groups who I wouldn't want defining for me what they consider to be violence or bad sex or family values. I wonder if you think that pressure groups is a good alternative now to the people having a voice and what kind of programming they get on television?
Well, I suppose it's better than nothing because at least it keeps executives on their toes, so they have to have what relate to them in a way that we call public relations. So they have to placate them. But I agree with you. The present system of pressure groups makes it very easy to play off one against the other because if you're in an executive position and you're approached by a pressure group, makes a demand, you can always say, well, there is this other group that demands the opposite, so since you're both mad at me, I'm doing the right thing. Now, the question is, that you can even raise this question, and that many people do, shows that we're very poor in our imagination, and we don't know what's going on around the world. This is not the system that most democratic countries have. In most democratic countries, there is some organized way in which you have not individual pressure groups, but you have a variety of interests represented. And if you know that, and if you're the member of any one, you know that the only way you can get some of yours is to let the others have an equal right. So finally, if you get all the pressure groups organized as a democratic political system tries to do, then you have to guarantee the rights of a wide variety of groups, of points of view, of perspectives to be represented. And under those circumstances, the individual pressure group cannot monopolize and cannot dictate to anybody else.
There are so many more stations now between UHF and cable for people who can get cable. And then you have the choice of, if you have a video cassette recorder, you have the choice of renting a movie for your television, or you could tape a show that you want to see and play it back at a time than when it wasn't supposed to be on in the first place. Do you think that that kind of choice, that the volume that we have now is making television a more democratic medium, or really giving us more choice. You used that analogy of the cafeteria before. Was the cafeteria changing now that the menu has changed?
It's changing, but not necessarily in the direction that the proponents of these new media seem to suggest. The confusing part is that much of this comes through our television set. But in the future, so will print, so will many other services, so that we have to distinguish, regardless of whether it comes through the set or through a piece of paper, we have to distinguish between two kinds of media. Selectively used media, like books, like magazines, like cable, like cassettes, like phonograph records, even though they're different media, they belong in the camp of selectively used media. And there is another medium, which is a ritual, which is a relatively non-selectively used medium, which is basic over-the-air television. Even if they come through the same set, these are entirely different. One, you pick and you program. The other programs you. The programming participation into the mass ritual, it can only be through some kind of citizenship. Now, the selectively used electronic media, like cable and cassettes, seem to be an enrichment over television, but an impoverishment in many ways over what's found in print. And that is what they're going to replace. Going out to the movies, reading books. In fact, they have already transformed the book publishing industry in many powerful ways. So you have to look at the trade-offs on the selectively used side and ask yourself, does cable give you more varieties than a library? And when you ask yourself that question, and when you contemplate that print itself is becoming electronically owned, the publishing industry is becoming electronically owned and eventually electronically distributed, you are looking forward to the prospect of greater centralized control over what used to be fairly diffuse and diverse, and greater capital investment required for entry into that market.
So can I make a distinction here? What bothers you isn't that it's a visual medium that might take supremacy over the printed word. What bothers you is the more centralized control over all mass media that you see happening now.
And the potential of ultimately no more than 2 or 3 dozen major international conglomerates producing for an international market the bulk of what hundreds of millions of people see, hear, and live in.
You've been quoted as saying that you'd like to start something that's the equivalent of the environmental movement and have it directed at the mass media. Could you describe the kind of movement you have in mind?
Well, as we speak about the movement eliminating or at least reducing pollution, of considering the industrial byproduct, the industrial wastes, you know, the other side of the industrial coin that has created enormous problems in our physical environment. I'm looking at the other side of the industrial coin of mass producing stories and messages, which on one hand is, I think, indispensable for modern living, and I think has brought many riches to people and has provided a kind of commonality, even social cohesion among otherwise very disparate and very different groups of people. But that too has a discharge, has another side of this coin, which is the excessive control, the limitation in the number of points of view, the number of groups, the number of interests in our society that can gain representation, the structure of power, which tells people that they can dominate. If they are born into the right group, they can dominate other people. The reduction and restriction of life chances of the people that we call minorities, including women, which is a minority in some sense of power, even though it's a majority in numbers, the market-oriented and relatively narrow basis, namely advertising resources and advertising support, on behalf of which the total enterprise that has become the universal curriculum of all our children has to operate. So that that I'm saying, let us now also attend to the symbolic environment, to the environment of stories and images and information in which we grow up, and let us look at the resource base, which is all too narrow, and see if we can broaden it so that it is capable of addressing a wider variety of interests, of human interests, of points of view of groups, and of perspectives on life, give us more options and more choices as people and as citizens.
I'd like you to answer briefly about this. I know you're broadcasting this interview now. We're speaking on public radio, and I don't mean for you to be influenced by by the fact that we're here on public radio now. But do you think that public radio and public television are fulfilling their mission at all in providing a mass media service that isn't as influenced by sponsors and demographics and so on, the things that you've criticized television?
Well, this is less and less possible in an era that is misnamed deregulation, which is a shifting of controls into more restricted and more private hands over which citizens have less and less control, accompanied by a reduction of citizen support or public support for broadcasting. This is becoming more and more difficult. But then the mission of public broadcasting in the United States has never been one of substitute service. It has been a supplementary service. I think it has been by heroic efforts that public broadcasting has even achieved the stature of being a partial substitute for some people, but it was never meant to be. Most of the action is in commercial broadcasting, and even for the large public, and I think an increasing public that watches public broadcasting, public radio, public television, it is relegated, because of the resources that it has been given, it is relegated to the role of a supplement rather than a substitute.
My guest is Dr. George Gerbner, the Dean of the Annenberg School of Communications and one of America's leading researchers on television and the mass media. You've made many criticisms of TV during the past hour, and a lot of people would use those criticisms as an argument to say, well, let's try to do away with TV, or therefore I will not allow a TV in my house, and if I have children, I don't want my children to watch TV. If they must watch it when they're at a friend's house, fine, but not under my roof. Do you support arguments like that, the let's get rid of TV, let's unplug it?
No, I don't. I think that's impractical and foolish. Any more than let's get rid of all our books. There is an almost equal amount of junk by any standard that is being published. No, I think it's like saying that if the environment is polluted, let's hold our nose. We don't have to breathe. No, we can't live that way. You can't live in a world in which 999 out of 1,000 people watch it, because even if you don't, you get it through other people. You have to take an active role in trying to become more analytical. That, I think, in many ways, is its own antidote. If you can understand what's behind the message, what is the message behind the message, that provides its own antidote. As far as our children are concerned, there is too much friction and too much tension in trying to make them do something that most of their friends don't do. Participate, explain, express your own point of view. Don't prohibit. Just take part in it as a parent. Then you have some standing in expressing your point of view, and do so.
If TV is the national storyteller, do you think it's a pretty crummy thing to do to remove your children from participating in those stories?
It's impossible. But on the whole, most children, left to themselves, watch less than their parents. The parents set the style of life in the home, and they have to be the example. Eventually, ultimately, the children will most likely model themselves after what parents do and not what parents say.
Did you ever have to confront these questions in your family?
Yes, we certainly did.
And you never banned your children, or did you structure your children's television watching hours?
Very, very little. It really conformed more to their hours of what we thought or they thought they should be doing. And I don't think we had to do it excessively, because we ourselves participate in a greater variety of cultural events, and didn't depend on television, and they didn't grow up as depending on television.
Do you have a utopian image in your mind of what TV could be like in a more participatory setting? Did you have programs that, I don't mean specific shows, mm-hmm. that you wanted to pitch, but do you have an idea of what you know, a better TV system would be like, what might be on it?
No, because I think it's too difficult and too early to set up a blueprint. I have a utopian image of a process, which is the process that I hope we as a nation and as a community will follow. Let's look around in the world. Every country, every civilized country, every democratic country today has to confront and had to confront this question. Many of them have come up with a great variety of creative solutions. We can learn from that and begin our own political process of trying to say, now, what is the uniquely American type of television or cultural mainstream organization, programming, values, objectives, and how can we move in the direction of a broader, freer, in a sense, more democratic and more pluralistic cultural process on television than what we have. This is a process that has hardly even begun, and I think that it's high time to start it.
Can you tell us what kind of TV you have at home? Is it color, black and white?
Both, but of course we have a color set. Once you get accustomed to good pictures in color, it's like old movies. They seem, anything else seem dated, and there's no reason why not. Even if for the occasional magnificent programs, and you say that I criticize television, I don't really criticize television. I understand perfectly well why television has to do what it has to do. I said the executives who run it have few degrees of freedom. I criticize ourselves as a community for not being more alert and aware and for being so slow in moving in the direction of helping the professionals, of helping the people in television to do better than to do as well as they know how to do, but cannot do because they cannot afford it under the present circumstances.
Well, one last question. Some people would say, well, yes, the system by which TV programs are produced has a lot of problems. But these people would argue the medium of television is a problem in and of itself because of the way TVs are. When you sit in front of a TV, you become passive and blank. Do you believe that?
No, I don't. I don't think that the advertisers pay $15 billion for people to be passive. Television is, in fact, the greatest mobilizing instrument in the history of the world. Don't be misled by the fact that people are sitting. People are sitting when they're reading books, too. There's no evidence that what comes through the tube is any more passive than what comes through the page or through the air like this. There's no evidence to say that because you have a total audiovisual experience that everything is spoon-fed or somehow funneled into your mind. There is evidence that if people have a wider selection of imagery in their mind, their imagination is in fact more active and more vital and richer.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks for
being here. I enjoyed
it. My guest has been Dr. George Gerbner. He's been dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania since 1964. He's directed many studies on how television pictures reality and how that picture of reality affects our own picture of reality. His studies have been widely published. They've been very influential. George Gerbner has been my guest. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening Monday on Fresh Air, but first, let's check in with shadow traffic.
Thank you. Bright sun glare is still affecting traffic on southbound City Avenue and portions of the Roosevelt Boulevard along with I-95. Northbound 95 still backed up in central Philadelphia around Penn's Landing where traffic squeezes into two lanes. Kelly Drive is jammed at the Falls Bridge. It takes about 40 minutes to travel on the Schuylkill Expressway between Montgomery Drive and Conshohocken in Pennsylvania through the construction near Belmont Avenue. I'm Bob Murphy, reporting shadow traffic on WHYY 91 FM.
That shadow traffic report was funded by the Pep Boys. Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be film critic Pauline Kael. This Monday at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, 91FM station manager Bill Seemring will be with us to discuss programming schedule changes, new programs, and then we'll open up the phones for your questions and comments about the programs here at 91FM. Tuesday at 3 o'clock, my guest will be Black South African poet and novelist Sipho Sampala. Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, my guest will be rock writer Nelson George, who wrote a new book, which is a history of the Motown record label. And Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, more on television, my guest will be television critics David Bianculli of the Philadelphia Inquirer and David Friedman of the Philadelphia Daily News, and we'll be talking about the current television season, so I hope you can be listening. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, I hope you write to us at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. The technical director for today's show was Audrey Vleblaitis. Amy Salad is the associate producer, Danny Miller, the co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good weekend. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered. That will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Lynn Neary.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Most people probably would feel that a woman aborting because she wanted only a girl or only a boy was terrible. I don't think it's any more right or wrong than it is to abort based on spina bifida or Down syndrome.
A new California law requires obstetricians to offer all patients a blood test that can detect serious problems in the fetus. Critics fear it's a first step toward creating a brave new world. The story tonight on All Things Considered.
Also in Houston, a memorial service for the crew of the Challenger.
A leading manufacturer of IUDs withdraws its products from the market, citing high legal costs.
And the flu, making the best of a bad situation. Now this news.
This is Laurie Waffenschmidt. The President and Mrs. Reagan joined the families of the Shuttle Challenger crew, aerospace workers, and other dignitaries today in a memorial service to the seven who died in the shuttle explosion on Tuesday. At the Johnson Space Center in Houston, the President eulogized the lost crew and said, despite the pain, they can be best remembered by Americans pressing on to explore the mysterious universe. Mr. Reagan promised an effective, safe, and efficient, but bold and committed space program. Investigators trying to determine the cause of the shuttle explosion today began examining at least five large pieces of Challenger's fuselage, including one piece 20 feet long. An undersea robot equipped with cameras has been deployed to look for wreckage on the ocean floor. The investigators are reportedly focusing on the theory that a ruptured splice in one of the booster rockets caused the disaster. A flame from the rupture could have hit the external fuel tank, setting off the 500,000 gallons of liquid oxygen and hydrogen. There were conflicting reports on the situation in Haiti today. This morning, White House spokesman Larry Speaks announced that the Haitian government had collapsed and that President Jean-Claude Duvalier had fled the country. But Duvalier went on radio and TV to deny the rumor, and within hours, U.S. officials admitted that the early reports were wrong and that the Haitian government was still in control. More from NPR's Tom Gelton.
Customarily, the White House reacts to foreign news rather than breaks it. So the report from spokesman Larry Speaks this morning came as a surprise. He told reporters aboard Air Force One en route to Houston that the U.S. government had independently confirmed the overthrow of Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, the dictator who has been ruling Haiti since his father died in 1971. Speaks said his news came from the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince, but the U.S. Embassy almost immediately contradicted the report, as a spokesman told a reporter that, as far as he knew, Duvalier was still in the country. At the State Department, an official said Speaks' report was premature, and at an official noon briefing, spokesman Bernard Kalb said there had been no change in government. The White House statement, Kalb said, was based on early reports that conflicted with later news. He did confirm, however, that there was sporadic gunfire and looting in the streets of the capital city, and he advised Americans not to visit Haiti until the situation becomes clearer. I'm Tom Gelton in Washington.
Angolan guerrilla leader Jonas Savimbi hinted today that his quest for U.S. aid has been successful. Savimbi is visiting the United States to seek support for his rebel group, which has been battling the Marxist government of Angola since 1975. President Reagan, who met with Savimbi yesterday, refused to comment on his plans for aid, but has pledged his support to Savimbi's cause. In South Africa, leaders of two black political movements have rejected a proposal by President P.W. Botha for a council to discuss black participation in government. That plan was offered during a speech by Botha today. Beatrice Hollier reports from Johannesburg.
Mr. Botha was welcomed as the first National Party leader to call apartheid an outdated concept. But many observers also noted his speech made no reference to cornerstones of apartheid, like the Group Areas Act, determining where blacks may live, or the Act classifying people into race groups. Regarding the end of the pass laws governing the movement of blacks, business leaders and black spokesmen stressed only the complete abolition of control.